From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, concern over Ebola outbreak on the rise, the threat from the Islamic State militants, more sanctions on Russia over Ukraine, plus crude oil prices in steep decline. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. World leaders declared the Ebola outbreak the worst global health emergency in years on Wednesday as governments stepped up measures to stop the virus from spreading from West Africa. As it emerged that the second healthcare worker to be infected in the United States had taken a domestic flight the day before she was quarantined, a new urgency gripped national governments. President Obama called his counterparts from Britain, France, Germany, and Italy, and the United Nations Security Council issued a stark warning that the outbreak was spreading out of control with nearly 4,500 lives lost already. European Union health ministers are to meet in Brussels later today with member states under pressure to follow Washington in sending troops to West Africa to help fight the virus. Separately, the United Nations Security Council is urging international community to accelerate and dramatically expand aid to the West African countries battling the epidemic. In a unanimously adopted statement, the 15-member body warned that the world's response had failed to date to adequately address the magnitude of the outbreak and its effects. Now, more on that latest case of Ebola in the U.S. 29-year-old Amber Vinson was immediately isolated after reporting she had a fever on Tuesday. Vinson is the second nurse to contract Ebola after taking care of a Liberian patient, Thomas Duncan, who died of Ebola last week at a Dallas, Texas hospital. Health officials announced on Wednesday that Vinson had been on a commercial flight from the U.S. state of Ohio to Dallas earlier this week. White House spokesman Josh Earnest attempted Wednesday to quell concerns from the public after Vincent was diagnosed with Ebola.
People should continue to be confident in the response that's organized by the government in reaction to this specific situation. The reason for that is simply that we have a modern medical infrastructure in place that, again, has not been flawless. We pointed out why that was the case, that even one transmission to a healthcare worker is unacceptable. People should take solace in the fact that, quite frankly, we know exactly how Ebola is transmitted. It's not transmitted through the air, it's not transmitted through food or water, but only through close contact with the bodily fluids of an individual that has symptoms of Ebola.
President Obama called an emergency meeting of his senior advisors involved in the Ebola crisis. That happened on Wednesday. He said the risk of a widespread Ebola outbreak in the U.S. is, in his words, very, very low if all the proper protections are taken. He called for an emergency federal medical team to be immediately deployed to any hospital where an Ebola case is diagnosed. And when pressed by reporters on Wednesday, Josh Earnest said there would be no so-called Ebola czar appointed at this time.
There are clear lines of responsibility that are in place. There is an individual here at the White House, a highly competent individual, Lisa Monaco, the president's Homeland Security Advisor, who's responsible for integrating that response. But again, if we determine that additional resources or additional staffing or additional expertise is needed to augment this response, then we won't hesitate to take advantage of it.
That is White House spokesperson Josh Earnest. Doctors Without Borders, known by the French acronym MSF, said on Wednesday it was reaching its limit and urgently needed other organizations to step up efforts against Ebola. MSF had been on the forefront of fighting the disease in West Africa. Brice de Lavigne, director of operations for MSF, spoke with reporters Wednesday.
For MSF, it's quite clear that we are reaching our limit. We have been saying that very clearly, that we have reached our limit in terms of increasing. That's why what we're still a bit astonished is the very slow and weak capacity of other actors, including state actors, including multilateral organization actors like WHO, like United Nations, and so on. I mean, they are deploying as we speak, but we still don't see the result in the field.
De Lavigne coordinates missions for MSF and oversees a facility in Brussels that trains volunteers heading for affected areas. It's the only such training center in Europe, although others operated by different organizations are set to open in Geneva and Berlin. At the Brussels Training Center, a group of trainees were being taught on Wednesday how to enter an Ebola field hospital and how to leave without infecting themselves. Paul Brockman is a project coordinator trainee who is traveling to Sierra Leone after his training.
We limit the number of times that we suit up and go into the actual high-risk zone where the patients themselves are to just a couple times a day so as not to, as you said, not to risk overheating, dehydration, or just a little bit too much for one day. You know, you need to err on the side of caution rather than the side of full speed ahead.
Spanish psychologist Carla Uyarte is likely to leave for Sierra Leone in November. She said on Wednesday she felt she would be safe.
I'm a bit scared of what I will be seeing, because I know that there's a lot of human suffering that I will be witnessing. And I'm also scared for our staff, because my colleagues will be going back to homes in which their family members might be dying. And I know that some of our colleagues, national staff colleagues, die. And not necessarily, and we do investigate this, because they get infected in the center, but because they're part of the community. So that is the part that scares me the most, no? Seeing for them, for their safety.
MSF currently operates 6 centers in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, with a total of 600 beds. Its personnel on the ground have grown from about 650 at the start of August to about 3,000 currently. And in Guinea, opposition parties are accusing the government of President Alpha Condé of playing politics with the Ebola outbreak as an excuse to delay municipal elections slated at the end of the year and also the presidential ballot in 2015. But as Karine Kamara reports from Conakry, many believe it would be impossible to organize voting with a health emergency of this magnitude.
The Ebola outbreak is impacting every part of life here in Guinea, restricting personal interactions, slowing commerce, and exhausting the healthcare system. But the political opposition says that is no reason to postpone elections in the coming month. This despite World Health Organization predictions that the number of new cases will spike up to 10,000 per week by December in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the hardest hit nations. Dansa Kuruma, chairman of the Guinean Civil Society Movement, says he thinks the government has no other choice but to delay voting in local elections this year and possibly presidential vote in 2015. He says Ebola is truly a serious public health threat in Guinea, and even though civil society members will never support a delay in elections, Ebola poses a unique challenge that will make voting impossible. He says all elements of society must do their part to contain Ebola, and politicians should not be playing politics. But the opposition is contending that the government will use the delay in order to rig an eventual election or to capitalize on its fight against Ebola to woo voters. Guinea only returned to civilian rule 4 years ago following a 2008 coup. The country held its first election in 2010, voting in Alpha Condé as a president in what international observers deemed a valid ballot. Parliamentary elections were held in September 2013 after repeated delays. The Guinean Electoral Commission has come under severe criticism in the wake of the postponement of this year's vote. The opposition is accusing the commission of bias in favor of the ruling RPG Rainbow Coalition Party and is planning to introduce a bill in parliament to restructure the commission. Liberia has also cancelled the national Senate election last week due to the Ebola epidemic. President Condé has stressed he's solely focusing on containing the Ebola outbreak, the worst in the history and which started in Guinea in December. Guinea has diagnosed more than 1,100 cases with more than 620 people dying from this virus. Health experts say the number are likely to be vastly higher than what officials have been able to record, given the scarcity of medical resources. There is no cure for Ebola, but early diagnosis and medical care can improve chances of survival. Currently, this Ebola outbreak has a mortality rate of 70%. Guinea's government is now calling on all retired doctors to come join the fight. Skilled medical personnel are one of the most critical needs in West Africa's battle against the virus. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
You can stay on top of what's happening with the Ebola outbreak at our website, voanews.com. Just look for our special reporting on the homepage.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
U.S. airstrikes around the Syrian town of Kobani are designed to relieve defenders and to buy time to try to build up forces in Syria to combat the Islamic State militants. That, according to retired U.S. General John Allen, special envoy in charge of building a coalition to fight the militants, spoke with reporters on Wednesday.
We're actually focusing, obviously, around Kobani, providing airstrikes to provide humanitarian assistance and relief there, obviously, to give some time to the fighters to organize on the ground. But in the Anbar province, our hope is to stop or halt that tactical initiative and momentum that they have there.
United States and its allies dramatically stepped up airstrikes in the past 2 days near Kobani, where Kurdish defenders said they had given the American targets coordinates to try to halt an Islamic State assault. The U.S.-led military coalition said it bombed Islamic State targets in and around Kobani nearly 40 times in the space of 48 hours, around triple the pace of last week. General Allen also discussed the status of Turkey's reluctance in joining the coalition's attack on the Islamic State.
We had, I think, very detailed and very constructive conversations with the Turks. You know, they're old friends and they're NATO partners, and we talked about a variety of areas where we could work together. The conversation with respect to how those kinds of details will ultimately be resolved is underway right now. The CENTCOM, UCOM team that is on the ground is talking about operational details. We have also committed to continued political consultation on the variety of ways that the Turks can contribute to the coalition. And there have already been, as you probably saw in the readout from my trip, there have already been some commitments by the Turks at this point in areas where they will be of assistance to us, with the idea that additional details will come from further consultation later.
The plight of the Syrian Kurds in Kobani provoked riots among Turkey's 15 million Kurds. That happened last week when at least 35 people were killed. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna for talks with Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif on international efforts to limit Iran's nuclear program. VOA's Scott Stearns reports from the Austrian capital.
Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Zarif are joined in these talks by European Union Representative Cathy Ashton, who's been leading efforts by Germany, Russia, England, France, China, and the United States to convince Iran to roll back its nuclear program in exchange for the lifting of some economic sanctions. A senior State Department official traveling with Kerry says there's enough time to get the technical work done if everyone can make the decisions they need to. In a televised address late Monday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said a settlement can be achieved by next month's deadline, November 24th. Step by step, Secretary Kerry said as the talks began. Among the significant gaps that remain in these talks are questions of how much uranium Iran will be allowed to enrich, to what level of purity. That would determine how long it would take Iran to develop a nuclear weapon should it decide to do so. Iran has long said its nuclear program is for peaceful civilian purposes, and it does not intend to build atomic weapons. But U.S. and European leaders believe Tehran has engaged in a covert program to build such devices. The senior State Department official says there are fundamental decisions that Iranians have to make on this issue, as international negotiators have been creative in trying to shut down Iran's pathway to a nuclear weapon. Creative does not equal concessions, the official said, criticizing intentional misperceptions about the course of these negotiations by those who the official said might not like what we're doing. Despite differences with Russia over its support for separatists in Ukraine, on the issue of these nuclear talks, officials say the six nations engaged here have remained remarkably united. Secretary Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov discussed the issue in Paris Tuesday, with both men saying they believe there could be agreement over the next 5 weeks. Foreign Minister Zarif and EU Representative Ashton remain in Vienna Thursday for talks with political directors from the six countries negotiating this deal. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Vienna.
Norway, not a member of the European Union, is the latest country to impose sanctions on Russia for its actions in Ukraine. VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshner looks at whether the international sanctions on Moscow are working.
The United States and the European Union have imposed several rounds of sanctions against Russia for its annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in March and support of pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Anders Aslund, a Russia expert with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says the first round of sanctions targeted people and enterprises either directly involved in Crimea's annexation or close to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
And since July, these sanctions have gone much further, dealing with whole sectors of the Russian economy, notably finance, high-tech, the energy sector and the defense sector.
Many experts, including Matthew Rojansky with the Washington-based Wilson Center, are now asking whether sanctions have worked.
Well, it depends on what your understanding of the purpose of sanctions is. My understanding is that it's mostly intended to change behavior, to deter bad behavior. And in that sense, probably not. Probably it hasn't worked.
Aslund agrees, saying normally sanctions do have an economic effect, but they do not necessarily have the desired political effect. He says the Russian economy is likely to be stagnant this year and probably will gradually decline in the next few years.
The big problem Russia has, its big vulnerability, is that Russia has foreign indebtedness of $730 billion, which is a lot of money. That is about 40% of its current gross domestic product, and it needs to refinance this to the tune of $160 billion a year, and this money is not available now.
Other problems facing the Russian economy include a 20% drop in the price of oil over the past few months. Oil accounts for 50% of Russia's exports. And the value of the Russian currency, the ruble, has dropped by 20% since the beginning of this year. Stephen Jones, a Russia expert at Mount Holyoke College, says Russia's economic woes are not necessarily due to international sanctions.
The Russian economic problems are due to other structural issues that the Russian economy has been facing for years, in particular Russia's dependence on high oil prices, which aren't so high now, and corruption, and the lack of any economic strategy that one can see in Russia that would modernize the economy. If Russia doesn't deal with those issues, it doesn't really matter what about sanctions.
In an effort to retaliate against Western sanctions, Moscow has placed restrictions of its own, such as banning imports of fish, meat, fruits, dairy products, and vegetables from those countries sanctioning Russia. Anders Aslund says when it comes to banning food imports, Moscow is essentially punishing itself.
And if you allow less food imports, as Russia now does, it means many bad things. You get a lot of black trade. It goes mainly through Belarus now. You get a shortage or less supply of food in various parts of the country, and you get higher prices and worse quality. The Kremlin is really hurting the Russian population.
In the final analysis, many experts say sanctions hurt not only the targeted country, but those who impose the punitive measures as well. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on the Voice of America.
Global oil prices are on the way down amid oversupply and a weaker economic activity in Europe and China. Washington Post newspaper says prices have fallen 23% since June. International Energy Agency has cut its oil demand growth forecast for this year to a rise of 700,000 for a total daily consumption of 92.4 million barrels and cut its 2015 forecast to 93.5 million barrels per day. Meanwhile, the Organization for Petroleum Exporting Countries, which controls about a third of the world's oil and usually reduces production with lower prices, seems willing to keep production levels unchained, at least until its next meeting in late November. OPEC production is currently at a 13-month high, bolstered by greater output from both Libya and Iraq. Carl Larry is president of the Houston-based Oil Outlooks and Opinions. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the shale oil revolution underway in the U.S. has made it more energy independent.
We're producing 8.6 million barrels a day of crude oil here in America. That's up nearly 4 million barrels a day from just 3 years ago. We're on target to see 9 million barrels a day by the end of this year. And there's predictions, and I believe in these, that we'll see 10 million barrels a day by next year. So that's number one, keeping pressure on the oil markets. And what happens because of that, because we're so oil independent and producing almost double what we have by next year, we've pushed out so many more imports that were coming into America. Well, if we're producing another 4 million barrels a day, we've pushed out 4 million barrels of imports of crude. And so that's in the global market. But because the global market, which is the second part, the global market's such in a weak demand state right now. The economies of Europe, the economies of China are really just kind of middling along here, not really getting any traction, not growing for sure. That extra 4 or 5 million barrels of crude that's in the market right now is not going anywhere. It has nowhere to go. And so there's no consumers out there, that major consumers, that are picking up that slack that we've backed out of our markets. So you have the strong U.S. production, which then translate into a backing out of imports, and that extra supply not being able to be absorbed by the global markets because of the weak economies. So you have this this perfect storm outside of the U.S. that's causing these prices to really come down very hard. It's something that we've never expected to see, because we never expected to see oil independence in America at these levels.
There's been a revolution in oil production in the U.S. It wasn't too long ago when people were saying the U.S. was on the decline as far as oil wells, many of them going dry.
That's absolutely right. If you were talking to any oil analyst, and myself included, just 3 years ago, nobody would have predicted that we would practically double our production by next year. Nobody saw this shale revolution coming. And now that it's here, there's so many repercussions that are affecting the rest of the world and ourselves. We're seeing the lowest gasoline prices, the lowest retail gasoline prices in America right now since 2001. And although demand is really at an all-time high here in the U.S., our gasoline prices are going down. And that's a definite correlation to the fact that we're producing so much crude here that we're getting it on the cheap.
Europe has been struggling in recent years, but China has been really charging ahead, signing oil contracts worldwide. What's going on in China?
Well, their growth has hit a little bit of a ceiling, and that's what's happening over in China. They're really operating at such high levels for so long, double digits at least until 2012 to 2011, and now they're back down to the single digits, and those single digits are kind of holding around 7%. What the world really wants to see is them back up at double digits, because that's when they can increase their consumption and they can see more imports going there. But the problem is that they need to, for global oil supply, that's the only large consumer left in the world.
So this glut will persist for, can you project how long?
I think the glut will continue to persist until somebody makes a production cut. At some point, OPEC, or even a wild card I'm thinking is Russia, will need to pull back their production to kind of balance the market out. Again, with the U.S. pushing back 5 million, maybe even 6 million in the next year or two into the global market, somebody has to make adjustments. And right now, it looks like it's going to be on OPEC unless we see some action from Russia.
That is Carl Larry. He is president of the Houston-based Oil Outlooks and Opinions, and he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Brent and U.S. crude futures fell on Wednesday, a day after posting their biggest daily drop in years. Brent lost 0.8% to $84.35 a barrel on Wednesday, while U.S. crude fell 0.7% to $81.26. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. Just simply look under the Programs tab for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Kelvin Fowler, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On October 16th, 1701, a charter was granted for a school in New Haven, Connecticut, to preserve the tradition of European liberal education in the New World. The school was renamed Yale College in 1718. Today, Yale is considered one of the nation's best universities. In 1781, at the end of the American Revolution, George Washington captured Yorktown, Virginia. After an attack by French and American forces just days earlier, British forces fled the city. The next day, they began talks on their surrender. On this date in 1793, Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France and Archduchess of Austria, was executed at the height of the French Revolution, 9 months after her husband, King Louis XVI, was beheaded. In 1846, William T.G. Morton demonstrated the use of ether as an anesthesia at the Massachusetts General Hospital. In 1859, on this day, radical abolitionist John Brown, along with a small band of supporters, seized the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, Virginia. A hoped-for uprising by area slaves never materialized. Brown was captured by U.S. Marines, convicted of treason, and executed. On this day in 1934, Chinese communist leader Mao Zedong broke through nationalist lines and began an epic flight from southwest China known as the Long March. The retreat to the west and north lasted for more than a year. Tens of thousands of Mao's followers died along the way. In 1964, the People's Republic of China joined the nuclear club after a successful test of an atomic bomb. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Assistant Secretary for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Daniel Russell and U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia and Pacific Security David Shearer recently visited Tokyo, Japan for the release of an interim report on reviewing U.S.-Japan guidelines for defense cooperation. A year ago, Secretary of State John Kerry and Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel announced in Tokyo their intention to review the U.S.-Japan guidelines for defense cooperation. The fact we have issued an interim report on a work in progress reflects the commitment to transparency that has been a hallmark of U.S.-Japan cooperation, Assistant Secretary Russell said. These bilateral defense guidelines serve as the policy framework that helps define our roles and our missions and our alliance capabilities. A similar review was last updated in 1997. It's worth asking ourselves, what's different today than in 1997, Assistant Secretary Russell said. We have longstanding and frankly growing threats, such as the ongoing North Korean nuclear weapons program and ballistic missile program. But new challenges have also emerged. The economic growth that has been a hallmark of the dynamic Asia-Pacific region is a direct function of the ability of all trading nations to utilize international waters, international airspace, and increasingly international cyberspace, Assistant Secretary Russell emphasized. It is incumbent on all of us, and certainly on major security contributors like the United States and Japan, to ensure that these common domains remain open to all. The updated guidelines aim to provide a framework for the United States, Japan, and other like-minded partners to expand their contributions. We want to look at greater flexibility, seamlessness, and an all-of-government approach, he added. We certainly also will look at ways to cooperate on regional issues and on capacity building for our friends and partners in the region. This process of review is taking a very strong and effective alliance and making it even stronger, Assistant Secretary Russell said in conclusion. The stronger the U.S.-Japan alliance is, the greater our joint contributions to regional and international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.